Hello and welcome to Plugged In. I'm Jim Malone. Greta Van Susteren is on assignment. This week, immigration, the travel ban, and their impact on American politics. We are live on Facebook and invite you to comment and take part. Coming to America and staying here has been the focus of U.S. politics for the past several weeks. Pictures and video of caged children in government-provided shelters produced outcry from both political parties over the Trump administration's policy of separating children from their parents after illegally crossing into the United States. Politics and public opinion forced President Trump to reverse course, signing an executive order to end the child separation policy. Now, a federal judge is ordering the government to reunite migrant parents with their children. More than 2,000 children were detained during the first 4 weeks of what the White House calls a zero-tolerance policy. Meantime, the U.S. Supreme Court gave President Trump what he called a tremendous victory regarding a controversial travel ban imposed on Muslim-majority nations. The justices split sharply in the 5-4 ruling. Chief Justice John Roberts wrote that the policy is squarely within the scope of presidential authority. In her dissent, Justice Sonia Sotomayor said the travel ban was motivated by hostility and animus toward the Muslim faith. The current iteration of the travel ban includes 5 mostly Muslim countries: Libya, Syria, Iran, Yemen, and Somalia. North Korea and Venezuela were added in the 3rd version of the ban. Joining me now, Victoria Maki, VOA's immigration correspondent, who's been covering the travel ban story since the order was first signed days into the Trump presidency. Victoria, happy to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
This is a major, long-awaited Supreme Court ruling. Definitely in terms of a political sense, it's a victory for the president. Legally, how broad is the scope of this? In a nutshell, what does it mean?
So this is pretty narrow, and on a conference call yesterday with the lawyers who were involved from the ACLU side, which were the plaintiffs and one of the plaintiffs in the case, they seem pretty optimistic that this is going to be really construed narrowly, that this will not have kind of wider ramifications on, you know, broader U.S. immigration policies. It'll stay pretty tightly focused, as it has been on these countries. Now, there are concerns, especially in immigration circles and among immigrants, that, you know, this will embolden and kind of give the Trump administration, you know, perhaps the motivation that they were looking for to either expand or somehow create a different and broader travel ban.
I mean, around the world, this has gotten a lot of attention and in many cases criticism. And there has been a fear at times that this is a per se Muslim ban. Has the Trump administration, have they taken steps to try to dissuade people around the world that this is in fact the case?
I think the closest they came to trying to dissuade was when they added North Korea and Venezuela in the 3rd iteration, which we saw last fall. Other than that, the majority, I mean, the countries that have been targeted every time have been predominantly Muslim. And, you know, especially Muslim American communities, they really see this as an affront to them. And, you know, in some cases, it's had direct impact on, for example, you know, the refugee population. We've seen the number of Muslim refugees arriving in the U.S. since the travel bans rolled out over 2017, dropped dramatically. And so, you know, those are the effects that we're seeing.
Many people focused on the president's rhetoric going back to the election campaign, where he talked about a Muslim ban. Even some of the justices who gave the president leeway on this question seem to be somewhat critical of the way he conducted sort of the campaign for it and some of his rhetoric.
Yes, I think they were careful to keep this in the legal realm. This was strictly about whether he had the authority to do it or not. But we saw, especially in the court, hearings leading up to yesterday, the judges along the way really did take issue at times with the fact that the president had espoused, you know, some pretty, I'd say, aggressive kind of rhetoric against Muslims.
And finally, in the 30 seconds or so we have left, there's been You know, it's a setback, I guess, for critics and opponents of this ban, but are they girding up for possibly future battles in the courts?
Yeah, I think the one thing that I've really seen consistently over the last year and a half is these court cases have really galvanized, you know, these activists and advocacy groups. They are ready to fight whatever comes down the pipeline, and they're very adamant about it. They do not want to back down whatever else comes down the pipeline from the Trump administration. They're ready to take it on.
Victoria Maki, thank you very much for joining us on the program today. Hours after the Supreme Court ruled on the travel ban, a federal judge in California ordered the Trump administration to stop separating children from their parents at the border. And he also required the reunification of families who have been separated within 30 days. Little has been said by the president or other top administration officials about reunifying children with parents since the president signed an executive order to end the separation policy. He downplayed a report saying that he regretted signing the order.
No, the executive order was great. It was something that I felt we had to do. We want children staying together. The laws are obsolete. The laws are horrible having to do with the border, both in terms of security and in terms of taking care of people. We're taking care of a lot of problems that should have been taken care of over the years. Well, one of the highest on the list is immigration, and we have to change our laws. We have to make them sensible. We want strong borders, and we want no crime. Strong borders, we want no crime. The Democrats want open borders, and they don't care about crime. And they don't care about our military. I care about our military. That's what we want, and that's what we're going to get. And we're going to get it sooner than people think. Thank you very much. Thank you, everybody.
Joining us now from New York is VOA Spanish service correspondent Celia Mendoza. Celia has been working on a story of a woman from Guatemala who crossed illegally into the United States. She's now being detained in the state of Arizona while her children are in a detention center nearly 4,000 kilometers away in New York. Celia, you've been speaking to this woman and her lawyer. What have you discovered?
Jim, what we have seen during the past month in this case in particular is that the feeling of frustration, not only by the family, but also by the lawyer, because they're not able to communicate, not only the mother with the children, but also the lawyer who is in New York and hasn't been able to have access to the children. That is one of the comments that we have seen, and especially the lawyer, Jose Orechana, which is based here in New York, has shared with us what are the feelings of the mother in terms of the communication and the access to her children.
Dire feelings about from mom. She is desperate to have her children returned to her. She's telling me that there's so many women there, so many women separated from their children, that they're desperate. Luckily, mom is one of the fortunate ones that have family here in the United States that can afford to pay an attorney. But there are so many women out there that have no one to.
In her case, she has been able to have a private lawyer. The family in North Carolina is helping her, and that's the reason why she has legal advice. But other people, especially those women that are in Eloy, Arizona, we know there are hundreds of women that are detained there. According to this woman, Jenny Gonzalez from Guatemala, they don't have anybody to represent them.
Can you tell us, why did this lady decide to undertake this journey?
That is a very good question, and one that they say the answer is not as simple as we will think. However, the conditions in their country, Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, which is the countries where they usually come from, are very, very dangerous. Their kids are threatened by gangs and violence. Poverty is one of the big issues as well. And they decide that to make this dangerous journey, coming miles and miles through dangerous locations and getting access to people that are not very good people. We're talking about the coyotes and people that are crossing them into the United States. But they say that's the only option, and they see the United States as a place of asylum and refuge, a place where their children will have the opportunity that they believe they don't have in their country, especially because many of the children will have a future in gangs and violence if they don't leave their country.
And finally and briefly, if you could, Celia, has she been able to communicate with her children during the detention?
She has communicated twice, according to her lawyer, one about a month ago when she was detained, and the last one the past weekend, and that is something that they hopefully want to fix. The lawyer says that they're trying to bring the case to a legal court here in New York because, as I said, he hasn't been able to have access to the three children, 10, 8, and 5-year-olds, which are here in New York.
Celia, thanks very much for joining us from New York today. Appreciate it. VOA immigration reporter Alini Barros was in Texas last week before and after President Trump signed the order ending the child separation policy. Now, Alini, I want to get a firsthand impression from you about what you saw during your trip to the border area.
So when we were there, we actually were able to witness the families being released from detention, arriving at this bus station in McAllen, and then having the first contact with volunteers who would tell them, you know, inside of your yellow envelope, you have to make sure you hold to this, then you're going to walk to this humanitarian center, and from there, you're going to get more directions on what to do. Once they were there, they would get a hot meal and some, you know, 101 life skills on what to do and what to expect on their journey to whatever final destination they were going. So at the humanitarian center, they also got to speak with a lawyer and call family members if they had family members here in the U.S.
Was there a sense that once the president signed this executive order, I mean, what was there any noticeable impact on the ground down there? Were people aware of what was going on?
We went to a vigil and, you know, lots of people condemning what was happening. But there was the sense of, okay, this is a step in the right direction, that at least he's acknowledging that we should stop separating families. At the bus station and being in touch with these families, there was a lot of small children, 3, 5, 4-year-olds. We talked to a father who said that here he's hoping to be free. We talked to a mother who said that one of the reasons she decided to make this journey was because her children kept asking food and water and anything to drink, and she didn't have anything. We spoke with an attorney from the Texas Civil Rights Project who said he wanted to ask her why she was coming, but then when she said, well, I was raped and my 6-year-old was raped, he couldn't ask her why she was coming. He understood why. So as you can imagine, we talked to so many people, and they all had their own unique, you know, experiences and reasons why they were coming here. However, there's also this expectation that we think they know what to expect, and everyone that we spoke with said, we had no idea the journey was going to be this hard, and we had no idea that they might take my children away from me.
And yet, as far as we can tell, people are still coming in, even with the uncertainty, in some cases the chaos, the prospect of being separated. They're still coming.
They're still coming, and I asked Sister Norma Pimentel from Catholic Charities why they were coming. And she said, look, it's bad over there, but here they at least can try to get some sort of protection. And they come with this idea of, what type of protection maybe I can get? They don't understand the word asylum. I asked a few people, so are you going to apply? Are you going to file for asylum? Do you have any sort of lawyer representation, anyone helping you? And the question that I got back was, what's asylum? Mm. So,
wow. Situation still has a lot to be sorted out, and we look forward to your reporting on this issue in the days and weeks to come.
Thanks,
Alini, for joining us today. At least three different polls show about 2/3 of Americans oppose the child separation policy. Now, VOA Urdu correspondent Deepak Dopal drove about 65 kilometers away from Washington to Bristow, Virginia, where some of the detained children are being housed. He spoke to a couple of longtime residents about how they feel about the policy and the results.
I was shocked to hear that it when the kids were being shipped here in Bristow. It kind of made it real to me, very close and very personal to the fact that it brought it to life more than anything. I knew that the kids were being taken away and housed somewhere, but to say it's in my own neighborhood, it just kind of set me back for a while. Youth for Tomorrow is approximately 2.5 miles from the house. Drive by it often when I go out to the grocery stores. I do believe that the Youth for Tomorrow is a place that they will get some help and guidance. But for me, I mean, it bothers me, but you just have to keep going. There's nothing that you can, there's nothing that I know that I can do to stop it.
I don't have a reaction really to them being in the neighborhood. Once the kids are separated, if it becomes a fact that they're separated from the parents and they wind up being here, then I guess this facility is as good as any. I do advocate things that prevent us getting to this situation, getting to the point where we have thousands of people at the border trying to get in. I think we have to respect the humanitarian needs that these people have, but we have to maintain our borders. It just, we have to do that. I'm struggling a little bit here. I don't know a simple answer. There's an old saying that sometimes you have to be cruel to be kind. There are all kinds of sayings about tough love. And this is a case where there's an element of toughness that's needed with respect to administering the borders. And we have to love our neighbor. We have to have in mind the humanitarian interest of those people that need help. Not easy.
A record high 75% of Americans believe immigration is good for the United States. The recent Gallup poll also shows a record low 29% of Americans think immigration should be decreased. Now, with that public opinion in mind, we turn to our White House Bureau Chief, Steve Herman. Steve, good to see you.
Good to see you, Jim.
You've been following the ups and downs of the Trump presidency. And, of course, of late, the focus has all been immigration. Really one of his pet issues going right back to the very beginnings of his campaign.
Absolutely. This has been front and center for Donald Trump since he decided to run for president. And this really talks to his base. And we have to remember that that base is what got Donald Trump elected. And part of that was this concern in this country, especially among older white males, about a changing America and feeling that the America that they know and love somehow is going to be imperiled by a browning of the United States.
Was there any sense at the White House when the president had to change course and reverse this policy of separating children from parents? I mean, I noticed he talked about the reaction of his daughter. Right. His wife, Melania, the first lady, went to the border.
All former first ladies, in fact, were in opposition to this and made that public.
Right. And so, in a sense, there was this sort of softening coming from the women in the family. But the president, at times, looked uncomfortable, though, having to undo that.
Absolutely. This was a rare retreat we saw. And I should say it's a tactical retreat. It's not a strategic change. And he has continued with blaming this on the Democrats, that it's not his fault. This is a big problem that he's inherited. He's going to fix it. But he does make these knee-jerk decisions sometimes, ignoring the advice of some of the more seasoned directors, advisors in the White House and outside the White House. And it's obvious that that's where this came from. And then he was compelled to change a direction, albeit we would think temporarily.
The Democrats at the moment see to make some hay on this issue of family separation, the sympathy, empathy aspect.
Sure.
But is, you know, immigration can cut both ways. And there's that solid base. We see it in Congress and among Trump supporters. Is there any thought that what he's doing by emphasizing the tough border policy is a way to get his supporters sort of excited about the elections?
Oh, absolutely. And the more reaction there is from Democrats, from people going out on the streets demonstrating about this, that plays to the base. And it's very critical in the November midterms for that base to turn out if the Republicans are going to hold on to the House and perhaps also some key Senate seats, as you know. And so there has been this strategy inside the White House and with the Republican Party itself to really force emotional reactions in public from Democrats to show the base that they really need to get out to preserve the status quo.
Certainly, it looks like it's going to be an issue right through November and beyond.
No doubt about it.
Steve Herman, thanks very much. For Congress now, immigration reform has been an exercise in futility for several decades. Now the House of Representatives will try again to pass an immigration bill that deals with the current crisis, spends money for President Trump's border wall, and addresses the status of people who were brought illegally into the United States by their parents and grew up American in every way, but without having the proper papers. VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson joins us now from Capitol Hill. Catherine, what are the chances the Republican majority can pass their own compromise bill?
Well, they're pretty slim up here, Jim. And if you take a look at some of the issues that they're being asked to tackle this week in that vote, you can clearly see why it's such a tough ask of them. We know that they're trying to address the situation of those undocumented young people brought to the U.S. as children who want a path to citizenship so that they can stay here in this country. Now, House conservatives say that that's an amnesty, that that's rewarding people who came here without documents, and they simply don't want to do it, particularly in a midterm election year. What they want are some of the other elements in this bill that'll come up for a vote. That's an e-verification system, providing employers with verification that their employees have documents. They want cuts to legal immigration along with President Trump. And that's simply a non-starter for the House moderates who are hearing from their constituents that they don't need to be as hardline on immigration. So it's really a matter of herding cats up here on Capitol Hill, getting everyone on the same page. And it just looks like it's not going to happen.
Yeah, some of those cats at times seems like they might want to scratch one another. And it gets to the divide within the Republican Party, which they don't seem to be able to overcome. I mean, a couple of interesting things. We hear no talk about trying to get Democrats in on some sort of compromise, which eventually seems like the only way to get anything comprehensive done. Right. But the Republicans just seem cannot get over this divide within the party between those who fear any sort of amnesty and those who are worried about their own political fates in November, because in the districts they represent, there is sympathy for the DACA recipients and the immigrants.
There is definitely a lot of sympathy for those DACA recipients, Jim. But the problem is that if you have all of these warring elements up on Capitol Hill in the House, you need a leadership voice to kind of bring them all together. You have House Speaker Paul Ryan, but we know that he's something of a lame duck. We know that he's leaving after these midterm elections this year. And we've actually been looking to President Trump up here to see where he stands on this bill. And quite frankly, he has been a little bit all over the place in the past week. House Republicans talking to me have said we just need to hear that one push from the president. And if he does do that in a tweet, which he has, then it might be enough, but it might be a little too late.
Well, Catherine, we know you'll be following the bouncing ball up on the Hill, and it looks like there's no end to the bouncing between now and November.
Thanks very much
for joining us. Joining me now to talk about the immigration's political impact moving forward is Laura Brown, director of the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here.
It's great to have you here. And, you know, it has become such a political focus in recent weeks. And I wanted to get your take first and foremost, just generally on the political fallout. How is this impacting the U.S. politics at the moment?
Well, it's certainly engaging the interests of the country. I mean, when you look at some of the recent survey data, about 19% of Americans who are looking toward the midterm elections are saying that they really want their candidates in their districts to talk about immigration. So, in fact, in an open-ended format, that's a very large number of people. The interesting part, according to Pew Research data, is that many more feel that the Democratic Party is the better party to handle the issue of immigration. In fact, there's a 14 percentage point advantage for the Democrats on immigration. So while the president believes, you know, this is doing a lot to energize his base, he is also, in some ways, energizing Democrats and, in fact, turning off those moderates that he's going to need in the districts that are vulnerable for the Republicans.
Yeah, I mean, there is a bit of a complicated formula here in the sense that there are Republicans in districts that we call kind of battleground districts,
yes,
where they need to be more moderate, and they have been clamoring for Congress to do something to kind of help them out. But at the other side of the party, you have more hardline immigration folks who see any kind of yielding as an amnesty that their constituents believe is something that they just can't stand. The immigration issue has cut both ways historically in this country.
It has, and I think this is where this is a misreading on the part of the president and some of his closest advisors, because they are thinking about a national election. They are thinking about turning the states to change the Electoral College. They are not thinking about the districts that are, in fact, vulnerable. When you look at somebody like Representative Will Hurd, whose district is in southern Texas, whose district also went to Hillary Clinton, but he happened to win, this is a vital issue for him, that he looks like he's solving the problem, not just fighting about it.
The president's poll ratings have been the subject of much discussion since he came into office. They're not great for an incumbent president at the moment. That can play into midterm results. As you look ahead to November, what is the general lay of the land right now? Which party seems to have an advantage?
Well, I do think the Democrats have an advantage. I do think that when you look underneath the polling data for the president, what you see is a sharply divided Republican Party. Some who very much strongly approve of what he's doing, and that is the Tea Party evangelical base, and others who are not pleased with his conduct and don't really like the policy direction or the brand that he is forging for the Republican Party. And that's a problem for him to have a divided party going into a midterm.
And finally, as we look ahead, the president has spent so much time cultivating his base and shoring that up. Is there any risk to that strategy in these national elections?
Well, I think the risk is more sort of long-term in the sense of what the Republican Party becomes should they lose the House of Representatives. What happens to the Republicans? Do they, in fact, lose the people who sort of held their nose and voted for candidate Donald Trump because they disliked Hillary Clinton?
Laura Brown from George Washington University, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks, Jim.
We appreciate it. Well, that's all the time we have for today. I'm Jim Malone. Greta will be back next week for another edition of Plugged In. Thanks for watching.